The first thing I would say is how unanalogous the last decade and even the last 35 years are. So first, a lot of what instinctively market participants and investors think is right could easily be wrong, because this is a radically different world. If you take essentially falling nominal interest rates, falling real interest rates, financialization and globalization, all of those huge arcs that have played out and affected so much of how markets have worked over the last, you know, 35, 40 years have reached their limits, are going the opposite direction. So the grounding that many of those experiences that we've all had as living through those periods can be very misleading.
I'm Jim Haskell, editor of the Bridgewater Daily Observations. The last few weeks have been an extremely trying period, both for the world and for markets and economies. Investors were already facing down higher levels of inflation and a shift towards tightening by central banks. And now the Russian invasion of Ukraine compounds existing inflationary pressures. It adds a new layer of uncertainty and risk and has ushered in big geopolitical changes that could reorient the post-war economic order in major ways. And so to help us make sense of all these challenging dynamics, I'm joined by co-CIO Greg Jensen. And Greg, I want to start with the thing that's at the top of everyone's minds, which is the war in Ukraine. Obviously, it's a tragedy and there's such a devastating human cost and loss of life. But I want to ask you here, how are you processing the situation as an investor?
Yeah, great question, Jim, because I think this is so critical. So a war hits us on so many levels, right? It hits our emotionally, it hits confidence in it. Then at the economic machine level, is kind of the easiest way that we get grounding, which is, well, how will this affect money and credit flows? And how will this affect the supply of assets and the supply of goods and services? And when you look at the war through that window, right, you could start to pencil out what's going on. And in a sense, this has accelerated what was already happening, right? Coming out of COVID, we went into an MP3 world that we've described a lot, of the combination of fiscal and monetary policy that had created a lot more demand than there was supply. And this war, in many ways, has accelerated that and led us to a situation where you have a tremendous amount of inflationary pressure at the same time, some degree of stagflationary pressure. Because when money is coming out of the system because central banks are being forced to tighten due to the inflation rates, governments, though, are going to accelerate their spending anew. Government spending had been massive during the financial crisis, was slowing, but this crisis, particularly in Europe, but also in the US, is likely to lead to more government credit in order to take care of the events of this, build out more military and energy infrastructure that's independent of Russia. At the same time, the supply of goods is impacted in a significant way, most importantly by what's happening in Russia, but also kind of the lingering effects of the pandemic and to some extent it worsening in China at the moment. So you've got an acceleration of the inflationary periods, inflationary pressures. At the same time, you've got some significant growth. First, the commodity shortages is leading to more money being spent on commodities than other things. And second, you've got the movement in financial assets and the effect of higher interest rates flowing through to the economy. So while before the Russian crisis, there was a growing risk of stagflation, it's significantly accelerated when you look at the effect of what's happening through a money and credit lens.
So let's talk a little bit about that growth story, because you did mention that stagflation was starting to be a word that was being used in the markets even before this war. And because global demand was outstripping supply and prices were rising, and one could see that that could become unaffordable and start to crimp demand, particularly in the US. But where do you think the growth story is most impacted as you sort of look out from the core of the war and across the world? Where are the areas that you would suspect to see this first? And where are the areas do you think that would be relatively unaffected in terms of growth?
Well, it's really rippling through most everywhere in a sense because of the effects on global commodity prices and supply chains that you're seeing challenges resulting from the war everywhere. But of course, there's concentrated challenges on the countries, on the areas where either Russian energy were a big deal, that's Europe clearly, and places where the Russian supply chain are particularly relevant to some extent. That's true in certain types of chips and Japanese autos and some other places in the world. Those are probably the the most directly impacted areas. But the whole world is going to have this negative shock from essentially a supply shock. At the same time, you need more spending, right? So the supply shock itself is stagflationary, clearly. But on the other side, in terms of real growth, you're going to have this acceleration of government deficits after they were coming down post-COVID emergency. You've got a new emergency, and you're going to see a shift to higher defense spending by governments. You're going to see a significant investment in domestic energy production capacity. Then you have both governments and corporates need to rebuild supply chains. And that's happening very quickly. That itself creates some real growth, but also creates a lot of inflation as you're doing that. And finally, rebuilding inventories. And I think just as you had in the 70s, a totally different psychology around inventories. That if you take inventories for the last 30 years, they were seen as bad. It was wasteful to hold inventory, and prices of things generally went down. And so the idea of building inventory was extremely costly. And today, building inventories is necessary. Nobody has any inventories. That's the first thing. And secondly, the recognition that your supply chain can go out at any time is leading to the need and the desire to stockpile. And so you're going to see stockpiling of real goods. So this is a shift from a radically financialized economy to one where investing in the real economy becomes a much bigger deal. And so that has a lot of growth effect and a lot of inflation effect. So you've got the big negative to growth from the supply shock leading to money getting taken out of the hand of consumers, but you've got a positive on the other side in terms of more government spending and rebuilding of infrastructure. Of course, that type of growth, the growth that comes from this kind of shock, is not wealth creating. It's rebuilding lost wealth. And that's really going to be the story over the next year or 2 years in the global economy, rebuilding essentially these inventories and rebuilding supply chains is just kind of recreating the level of economy you had before all of this disruption. It'll lead to GDP because that's kind of just calculating the existing churn. But in terms of wealth creation, it's really recasting all of this lost wealth and rebuilding again. So that's kind of the picture. And I think from a real growth perspective, it's probably a little bit better than people are expecting in terms of GDP. But because that GDP is being built to make up for lost wealth, it's certainly not as positive in aggregate as normal GDP would be.
In terms of the big markets, stocks and bonds, it seems like these dynamics you're describing, the inflation, potentially verging into stagflation, more government spending, the increased need to tighten, these would be bearish pressures.
Yeah, well, we discussed, you know, I've been discussing the big hole, liquidity hole that's opening up in markets as the government was continuing to run a budget deficit. The Fed was pulling out of QE due to inflationary pressures, and the government had to fund it. And now you've got to fund even more with probably even less liquidity. The Fed is unlikely to be doing QE until inflation falls significantly from where it is. And so you've got this big hole that is driving down all assets. And this is part of what you should expect in a stagflationary environment where the Fed is reacting to the inflation rate. Markets were priced for a certain level of liquidity that's no longer likely to be there. And the real economy is absorbing a tremendous amount of liquidity. So you're seeing the money kind of coming out of the financial markets. And that's really an important thing. And that means how you get diversification in this world is particularly difficult. So thinking through diversification totally differently, if you take the assets that have been least correlated to equities, right? If you, over the last couple months, it's been commodities that have been extremely negatively correlated to equities. You take, you know, the 20 years before that, equities and commodities were 80, 90% correlated. Now they're significantly negatively correlated, and recognizing that's because correlation just falls out of the fundamental factors that are driving the global economy. And this is why commodities are such an important part of the portfolio over the last 20 years. It makes sense to sort of say, haven't helped very much. But the risk that you have today, a risk that always existed, a risk that happens in the 1970s as well, of course, and other periods of war, is that commodities become incredibly valuable and become a big diversifier to equity. So understanding the different periods and what assets will help diversify a portfolio in those different types of environments becomes such a huge critical question.
Greg, I want to ask you about the dilemma central banks are facing right now. Because if you look back to, let's say, the 1970s, One of the things that you've described in past conversations is the fact that in retrospect, it looks so easy. You know, the Fed should have tightened more during that period. But at the time, it wasn't so easy. They were balancing lots of different considerations. And if you fast forward to where we are today, the situation could be largely the same. The Fed is probably more behind than they were even in the 70s in terms of where inflation's running and where their interest rates are. But again, there's also lots of pressures not to tighten too quickly, especially with all the uncertainty from the Ukraine invasion. So how would you assess the trade-offs the central banks are right now facing?
Yeah, well, I think it's such a live case study of what you're describing, which is comparing what it's like to live through something versus study the history of it, of the 1970s inflation as an example. Living through the 1970s, if you take the accounts of the time, you can see why the Fed lagged behind. There's political pressure. There's the idea that these things are transient. You get an oil shock. Do you really want to tighten into an oil shock? It's not going to produce more oil if you tighten into an oil shock, and so on and so forth. And here we are. And I would agree that they are lagging. I'd expect them to lag inflation. They wanted to turn the tide of inflation. It was a purposeful policy for so long. Deflation and disinflation and the stagnant wages, all of these challenges were the secular challenges of the last 30, 40 years. Now we have turned a corner, in our view. We've turned a secular corner that the world is no longer nearly as deflationary as it was. Policymakers know how to deal with deflation in terms of MP3 policies. That's no longer the problem. The problem is the inflation sticking. And it's our view the inflation will likely stick and the Fed will lag behind. And I think the Fed, it's a difficult choice. I don't have that many complaints. I think the Fed should be tightening now. They're late, but it's understandable why they're slow and understandable why the uncertainty will keep them being slow. But today, the uncertainty around inflation is starting to become the bigger uncertainty than the uncertainty around growth. And the notion that it's transient has pretty much been debunked, like as we've shown. It was the demand, not the supply before the war that was causing the inflation. It was the MP3 policies. And you had to start to withdraw the easiness. And today you now actually have added on a real supply shock on top of a massive demand shock. And so the pressure on the Fed is higher than ever at a time when the uncertainty is also higher than ever. That's really hard. In all likelihood, when you mix those things, high uncertainty, high pressure to tighten, you're going to get tightening, but the tightening is likely to lag behind the inflationary pressures.
So just continuing on with this, in past conversations, Greg, we talked about what happens when a central bank loses its anchoring, you know, of inflation expectations. And one of the things you said is you need that anchor one way or another, whether it's a Volcker type of response where a central banker then switches to more of a preemptive tightening policy like Volcker did, but at great pain with the economy in the early 1980s, or in other cases, central banks aren't up to that, but have to anchor it to something that is credible. And that's where we get, you know, gold standards or things like that, currency boards and so on in certain countries in order to reestablish those types of anchors. Are we beginning to get at the point where investors have to think about those types of options? And especially when we're thinking about diversification and what is the proper diversification instrument and so on?
Well, I think you really have to stare at it. The cycle for currencies over very, very long periods of time are, as you described, you start with generally currencies that are pegged. You have some sort of credit problem on that peg that forces you to come off of that peg, that moves you to having interest rate policy. Eventually, the interest rate policy and fiat currency you eventually use to ease too much. And you lose the faith in the currency, which forces you to bring back the faith, either, like you said, through the Volcker type high real interest rates and a lot of discipline, or through a repegging. You've seen both of those through history, a repegging to something real. And I do think we haven't killed that arc. That arc is likely alive and well, and that's probably the case. In the 70s case, you come off Bretton Woods, you come off a peg, et cetera, and it's really only reestablished by extremely high real interest rates. In today's world, I think that that's a likely path, which is it requires higher interest rates than people expect to essentially restabilize inflation expectations. That's a possible path. It's also possible that you lose it and the US dollar faces the drag of having essentially pressured inflation up in this way. And on top of it, the global currencies are in many ways becoming much more dangerous for other countries to hold. Russia's obviously learning that lesson of being involved in the dollar system and the pain that can cause. Others will learn that, and to be independent of the dollar, they'll probably move off of this, this creating more inflation risk for the dollar as the global status of the dollar likely be questioned as well. So that's all going to likely lead to somehow that need to either peg the currency or, in a sense, peg it with a very significantly different type of monetary policy than we've experienced over the last decade, where the last decade, the answer was always be easier. And today, with what's happened with inflation, that answer is not going to stick.
What should investors do to diversify against this type of stagflation scenario? You know, it's tricky because most investors right now are concentrated in stocks and bonds, and actually increasingly just stocks, which could perform very poorly, especially in inflation-adjusted terms in that type of environment.
One of the challenges for most investors is over the last decade, diversification has been terrible. You just wanted U.S. equities, the more the better. Everything you moved to diversify out of U.S. equities took away from your return, didn't even add that much in terms of risk balancing. So diversification over, you know, the recent past hasn't been that helpful, but man, is it necessary. And like you said, it's complicated because you're in this very dangerous, very volatile world. And you certainly want some commodities and some gold as part of that diversification, in our view. You want to be protected from inflation with some inflation index bonds. As part of that, you want to deal with as much as you can geographic diversification. This becomes a further challenge in a deglobalizing world because you're dealing with not just economic risk, but also the political risk of where you're allowed to hold assets. And so our thought on that question is still, you want to be very careful in this world. You want to be diversified. You may take losses in one area, but the risks are very different everywhere in the world. And the risks are very different across asset classes. And it's more important than ever to be balanced, and particularly balanced to the stagflation risk that is a killer to most portfolios.
Is there an analogous period, Greg, that investors should look to for how things might play out? We've talked about the 70s in this conversation, for example, and we've previously written about the period around World War II in terms of the fiscal stimulus. You know, can those eras provide helpful context for how markets could play out, or is there another analogous period you'd highlight?
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing I would say is how unanalogous the last decade and even the last 35 years are. So first, a lot of what instinctively market participants and investors think is right could easily be wrong, because this is a radically different world. If you take essentially falling nominal interest rates, falling real interest rates, financialization and globalization, all of those huge arcs that have played out and affected so much of how markets have worked over the last, you know, 35, 40 years, have reached their limits, are going the opposite direction. So the grounding that many of those experiences that we've all had as living through those periods can be very misleading. And so I do think that nothing is perfect in terms of a perfect analog, but understanding both the buildup to World War I, the 30s and the 70s as part of, do you actually have a portfolio strategy that can survive that? The 30s of looking at how deglobalization worked during that period, what it's like to have massive sanctions on different countries and to have markets that were once available no longer open. All of those questions, as well as the buildup for war and the way the governments funded the wars, all those questions are super important. And then like the 70s of, in a little less military way, but it just generally having supply shocks and having monetary policy that's too easy relative to the conditions and falling behind inflation, those are really relevant. And so stress testing your portfolio and your thinking through those periods would be kind of the advice that we'd have. And certainly, you know, the stuff that we do with our tools all the time to say, not only can you survive the 30, 40 years that we've all experienced together, but can you survive the periods you haven't experienced, but come in a cyclical kind of way over longer periods of time, whether it's wars, whether it's inflations, and really have strategies that work for those periods.
I want to close, Greg, on some of the big geopolitical questions the Ukraine invasion has raised for investors. And the one that sticks out the most to me anyway, is the weaponization of finance, which, as far as I know, is unprecedented in our investing lifetimes. You know, maybe there's some other period I'm not aware of, but essentially, we're now in a situation where a country can have billions of dollars of international reserves that can literally vanish because of sanctions. And so I'm just wondering what you think the implications of this could be, given that the United States is being challenged in the world, and there are a number of countries that may want to protect themselves from having what happened to Russia happen to them.
Yeah, like you said, I don't think there is a comparable period, because even though you've had obviously graver tensions than we face today, you've never had a global currency as powerful in such a financially globalized world, right? Even in the 30s, where there were a lot of trade pipelines or whatever, global investing was more constrained. And so while there were a lot of controls that built up, the dollar wasn't nearly as central, and nor was the pound at that period as the dollar is today. And the lesson is crystal clear that you can't be in a strategic competition with a country in which you save in their currency. They'll always be able to win because they can always produce wealth faster than you can, and they can always hold your wealth hostage. So the world's coming to that. China's coming to that. Russia, even before this, and part of their preparation for this, of course, thought they had untangled themselves, but didn't quite as far as they expected. And so I think you're seeing this disentanglement in different financial systems. You're probably going to have different technological systems and different financial systems in the world with spheres of influence, where China has a sphere of influence, the US has a sphere of influence, potential Europe's sphere of influence. But this world that is divided, and that it's not one financial structure. And that's the world we're headed to. And it's a big deal. And certainly for the leading reserve currency, the US, the implications are big, that the era of being able to count on global savings coming into dollars is over, and that you're entering this new era of a new world order. And that's going to ripple through the levels of real interest rates. It's going to ripple through the inflationary pressures. And that understanding that trend and how that happens is a big deal. We've studied the movement from the guilder to the pound and the pound to the dollar. Each of those happened as a result of wars and changes in economic power. You know, that will play out once again here with the dollar declining. It's not that the dollar will be eliminated as the central currency, but it will become, in one sphere of influence, the critical currency, and other spheres of influence, other things will become the global currencies.
I want to talk to you about China here too, because, you know, up until now, despite the fact that there's been a growing rivalry between China and the United States, we have said to investors that we think it wise, given that it's a diversifying return stream, that they should at least passively and strategically be invested in a diversified set of assets in China. But looking at the Chinese interests as it pertains to Russia vis-a-vis the United States, would you still counsel that? Or would you worry that some of those diversification benefits could be reduced by virtue of the fact that politically China could be sanctioned like Russia was? How would you think about that issue?
It is very difficult, right? We would err on the side of the diversification still being worth it, and that risk that it becomes more and more difficult for US investors to hold Chinese assets is a risk. It's a risk we think is probably discounted, but potentially not. And that, again, it's with having it within your portfolio in a reasonable size, right? That for us, a global portfolio with 10 or 15% of its assets in China is appropriate. There is the risk that you won't be able to hold it, but there are a tremendous amount of benefits as well. If you look at the current market pricing, you look at how essentially policymakers in China are less constrained in terms of inflation, in terms of their ability to do fiscal than a lot of the Western economies are. And so it's definitely risky, but holding US assets is risky in a different way as well. And so from a portfolio balancing perspective, we still think China is important. And if you look at how their assets have done, even though the equity market's been down so much, a balanced mix of assets over the last year and a half has been perfectly great in China, despite some periods of very, very poor equity performance, because other assets have worked as designed. Bonds have helped to diversify equities, and bond yields in China are still high enough to do that. And commodities in local currency in China have created a good balance as well. So a balanced mix of assets has worked reasonably in China despite a negative equity environment. And now you have equity pricing that in our view looks extreme, certainly relative to the earnings. The risk premiums in holding Chinese assets are quite high, understandably, given the risks around them. But still, on net, we'd say the diversification appropriately sized is better than not having it.
Greg, thanks so much for joining me, and we'll check in again with you real soon.
Thanks, Jim.